Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to this bonus episode of Freedom Books, Flowers in the Moon, in which the TLS's fiction editor, Toby Lishtig, meets the Australian novelist Tim Winton to discuss his new novel, The Shepherd's Hut, recently extracted in the TLS. Toby began by asking Tim about Jaxie, his teenage protagonist.
Well, there are moments where I think he's a borderline sociopath. He's a brutalised kid who's... really, he's the fruit of misogyny. He's just been beaten and intimidated all his life and corralled into this very narrow form of masculinity, or a very narrow form of existence, really, by his circumstances. But he's tough. He's a bully at school. He has a bit of a taste for violence and a fairly narrow lexicon, I think it's safe to say. But he's curious. Even though he's been trained to close his fist and close his heart and close his mind, there's a kind of an incipient curiosity there that bubbles up and exposes him to things every now and again. I guess I've always been interested in people who, on the surface, seem to be very emphatically one thing, and it's almost always not what they are. How they seem is not what they are. And Jaxie's one of those people who's brimming, boiling with feeling, but doesn't always have the language with which to express those strong yearnings and feelings.
But he's creative with that narrow lexicon as well. I mean, it's the vernacular in the book is sort of fizzes and is exciting and interesting. So there is a kind of scope for playfulness with the language as well.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, he and I suppose, enjoy pushing that to the limit. He owns his own sound, if you know what I mean. He very definitely owns his own space and his tone. And sometimes he's completely unconscious of it, and other times he's reveling in it. It's a little bit, like when you travel in the South, in the States, and you hear people... self-consciously performing their southernness on you, and I'm sure Australians do it. They used to do it in Earl's Court. I heard a few of them in the tube yesterday, and you can't tell if they're just shoring one another up in their Australianness. They're just enjoying. So I think now and again he's performing because he's not sure. I mean, the conceit of the novel, like all conceits is pretty fragile. I mean, he's a boy who almost never says anything in his normal life, but because he's out in the middle of nowhere, he's uttering this story to the emptiness, with the assumption that no one's listening, so he feels free to say everything. And then every now and again, as you say, he sort of trowels it on pretty heavily in terms of the vernacular. Some of that's defiance and some of that is pleasure and fun for him, but also I have to confess, for me, if you're like me and you've grown up having been told your whole life that you're from the wrong side of the wrong continent in the wrong hemisphere, speaking a wrong version of the right language, could have been worse. It could have been francophone, but in the end, and the kind of headwind that creates for a writer who's essentially writing to the great world, regardless of its indifference, and you write in your own sound and your own language, and you don't tug any forelock. when you start from that position of, you know, it's an enormous disadvantage.
Do you think the world's perception or reaction to that kind of language has changed since you started writing in the early 80s? I mean, is there more receptiveness to it now?
Well, there's more receptiveness to me. So some of the, you know, for having been stubborn and held my nerve and paid the price for that for a long time, you know, there have been times, you know, Cloud Street was one of them back in 91, and the Shepherd's Hut is another moment where you get to use your own language, and the language of you know, the demotic that you're most familiar with and in a sense most enjoy. You get to deploy it shamelessly and defiantly, to no great cost. I mean, there some people will, in the States and in the UK, will be resistant because we have been trained into this kind of friction-free reading experiences, and I think the internet and television have encouraged this sort of friction-free experience. You just want everything to be seamless, the language to be instantly recognisable. There's no moment at which you have to stop and think, hang on, what's that? So the two things are going at the same time. You know, the strangeness of my sound is less strange than it was 30 years ago, and that's happy days for me. but at the same time, I'm still writing into a global culture now that is resistant to any friction, to any strangeness. You know, the very top of literary art, there's an openness to that, but more broadly speaking, people are less tolerant of difference, unless it's suitably exoticized and you trail on the mangoes.
Do you think there's a danger of that, your writing becoming exoticized in that way? I don't mean a mango so much, but the style, people thinking, oh well, this is different, and therefore sort of not treating you with the respect you deserve, but just treating you as a kind of an other rather than just as an author.
Yeah, look, I think if there was any danger in that, it would be the danger in me responding to that and pandering to that. So you don't want to just go out there every time giving them, you know, another serve of that. I mean, the places that I write about are strange and weird enough as it is without pandering, and also without insisting on, you know, the most extreme forms of demotic language. But you know, there are writers who I admire I've sometimes wondered whether they haven't actually recognised that they've got a bit of a thing, and then they follow up. And there's an element of pandering and hamming and mugging as a part of that, and I think that's kind of a shame. You know, they don't need to try that hard.
So Jax, he leaves his hometown under a potential cloud, and he goes out into one of those strange places, the Saltbush, absolutely beautifully described, and he comes across this figure. I wonder if you could tell me about him. He's called Fintan.
Because, you know, Jaxie just, you know, he wants to escape people. He wants solitude.
And also to find one person in particular. He wants to track down his love.
Yeah, he's searching for the only person who gets him, I guess, and who actually gives a damn about him. But for a while, he needs to lie low and let things cool off. And that's his back of the envelope plan that he's got about his entire future. But as happens, you know, you make plans and the world has other ideas, and there's someone else out there in the salt country, and he comes upon a stranger, and it's somebody, you know, two generations older than him, and who is a kind of an opposite in a way, somebody who has an education, who has cultural confidence. This guy Fintan McGillis is he turns out to be a disgraced Roman Catholic priest, an Irishman. And of course, you know, coming from his world, I mean, Fintan's world is musical and language heavy, and wordy, talky. So you've got this sullen teenager who's suspicious of uttering because it's unsafe. He comes up against this bloke who's just incontinent when it comes to talk, and it bewitches and irritates the hell out of Jaxie simultaneously.
And Jaxie's own kind of reticence probably does the same to Finton, I would say.
Yeah, you know how it is when you meet people who have a kind of a power silence, and you have to lean in and you just start babbling because they don't say anything. And they're both frightened of each other. They both see the other as a threat. Initially, Finton's been out there, so he's been parked out in the salt for years for reasons that we never really get to know the details of. But initially, he thinks that, you know, this urchin, you know, who's bearing a high-powered rifle, has been essentially sent out there to dispatch him, you know, and bury him, and no one will ever find him. So he thinks that, this is a cold-eyed child killer. And Jaxie just makes the assumptions that any reasonable teenager these days seems to make about someone who outs themselves as a cleric, that he's a kiddie fiddler, you know. So it's a very uncomfortable meeting, and
as soon as you say disgraced Roman Catholic priest, I mean,
yeah,
it's like ticking
that box. Yeah, we all know. We all seem to think we know what that's about. And so there's this sort of awkward dance between the two of them. And eventually, they form a kind of an alliance, which is logical and kind of necessary in that sort of environment. You can't live on your own in the interior of an island like Australia. It's not a place for solitaries. It never has been. People have only ever been able to live there. I mean, people have lived there for as long as people have been people, 60,000 years. But they've always done it in groups. They've always travelled in groups. They've always hunted in groups. They've always sung and done ceremony in groups. There's no place for the individual in historic pre-settlement culture. The European idea of, you know, romantic notions of solitaries in landscape, it just doesn't apply. The world, yes, it will reveal itself to you, and then it will kill you. So the two of them sort of form a kind of a partnership. It's easier to survive with two people than it is physically, but it's also emotionally
and spiritually as well.
Yeah, I think so. They feed one another. I mean, sometimes they're feeding each other, you know, poisonous tidbits, but they are, and they're goading one another and abusing one another. But there's food in it, there's nurture in it, there's and eventually, you know, to Jaxie's great horror and discomfort, there's affection in it as well. I mean, Jaxie's never had a male figure in his life show him any regard or affection or respect. And Finton's always saying to Jaxie that he's a marvel, that he's a miracle, that he's full of admiration for him. And Jaxie just thinks he's being sarcastic all the time. You know, he's just used to being flogged by his father and you know, given detention and punishment by schoolmasters. It's an interesting little dance, and in terms of forms of manhood, I think both of them get something out of it. You know, so here's this guy who's been a professional quote unquote father all his life, but has never been a father, and his relationships have always been procedural. And just by being in the middle of nowhere with a foul mouthed 15-year-old with a rifle, he actually is in a relationship with someone who he cares about and wants to survive, and will do in the end anything to make this kid prosper and survive. And there's nobody in Jaxie's life who's ever gone, you know, ever suggested or ever actually would go to the wall for him. And so in that sense, it's more than affection. It becomes, you know, it's like this child becomes every child who's ever existed in the mind of this crazy old priest. And in a way, even though he doesn't quite have the language to say it, Jaxie sees, you know, this old man as the father he never had, or as a vision of the world of old people who were beneath contempt, you know, actually having something to offer, you know. So, and he becomes the biggest sort of figure in his life, ever so briefly.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
And so these two figures are obviously right at the centre of what is in many ways a very pared-down novel. Landscape surrounds them. That's a huge part of it. And you've said, I think, elsewhere that you always start your writing with place. Mm. I just wondered if we could talk a little bit about that and your sort of relationship to the world as an environmentalist. And there's a movement in literature which some people call the ecological turn, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is, you know, about decentering humanity from writing, both in fiction and non-fiction. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about your views on that and the importance of you know, books not necessarily always being about people.
Yeah, and if they're going to be about people, not necessarily always being about the dance of manners, you know, and kind of the neurotic, brittle surfaces. Look, I think we're at a point in history where it's not just logical but probably necessary to be thinking differently about, you know, what the real terms of trade are in terms of what it is to be a human on this flying ball at this particular moment, where our ancestors used to live at the mercy of the natural world, and then after the Enlightenment and industrialization, it soon become evident that the world is now living at our mercy, and we've had this brief blip in history where that's been the case, where we've been able to tell ourselves we're the masters of the universe, not realizing that underneath all of that, the terms of trade have changed so much that we feel like masters of the universe, and yet we're going back to, you know, our ancestral origins, where we're now becoming creatures at the mercy of the natural world in ways that our ancestors never were, where it's not just a dance and a relationship between us and the natural world and an intertwining of dependencies. We're now looking at a future where we're essentially creatures fleeing the whirlwind. We're just running from, you know, from this big black storm and having to wake up to ourselves. So in terms of landscape and the natural world, it's just about, you know, it's interesting that in my lifetime, you know, there's this huge change in the way that we see ourselves, the way some of it's about returning to a notion of understanding that we're creatures. We've had a few centuries where we've become addicted to the idea that we're angelic beings, you know, where we live in a cosmos without consequence. So when it comes to writing about the world, it's just a change of proportion, a change of emphasis, and the natural world that so often in modern literature, at least, has just been backdrop. It's just been the stuff that you paint up behind the real action. The real action is the foreground, is the people on stage. I think we're now waking up to the fact that the backdrop is the foredrop, and the people on the stage are part of it, but they're not it.
Do you think there's almost a kind of, as a writer, a kind of a moral imperative for you to be painting it, you know, as more than just a backdrop, for you to be foregrounding the natural world in that way, or is it less, yes and no, I suppose.
I think given the existential moment that we're moving into, yes, you feel a moral impulse there, but I also feel it emotionally, and always have, that the natural world was alive, that wasn't just dead matter that was there to set off the colour of our eyes, you know. And that we were in a relationship with it, even if it was a dysfunctional relationship. I think that's it, the last century has taught us that we've been living in a dysfunctional relationship with the natural world. We understand that when we talk about marriages or friendships, but the science has made it very clear that that's actually very much part of the terms of trade, the way that we've lived in the past century and a half, and there are consequences to that, and we have to face them. But some of that change of mindset is an opportunity. I think you can too easily fall into a kind of an apocalyptic chastening kind of outlook, but I think it's an opportunity. We have a chance to live more richly. We have a chance to live better if we, as Robinson Jeffers used to say, if we uncenter ourselves and humanise ourselves and join up. I think Richard Powers is probably.
I was going to ask you,
better than anybody.
Have you read The Overstory?
Yeah,
I was going to ask
the most impressive novel I've read for years.
So this was Richard Powers' novel, which came out maybe 3 or 4 months ago.
Yeah.
There was a review in the TLS by Paul Quinn about it, but it's sort of trees are at the centre of that with humans.
Yeah, and it's essentially it's drawn from the science, and it's about relationships and interdependencies and the fact that all things are in families and all things are in tribes and all things are in villages, and trees are doing what we're doing, and you can scoff at that, but the science is there, and he brings that alive in an emotional way. And it's about I guess the thing I take from his book, apart from just how dizzyingly skillful he is, and what an enormous brain he must have to carry around on his shoulders. It must be tedious, but I finished that book in awe, because essentially it's art delivering humility to humans in a way that we've got to have the habit of expecting or even understanding. It's about perspective. And if you live if you're an Australian and you live outside the cities and you just stop long enough to look, you realise that you are just like a piece of dandruff on the back of an enormous ancient beast. And it seems indifferent to you, but you belong to it. It's just that you're not it. You're not everything. You're not the pinnacle. You aren't the master of this universe. You're a fleck. But to realise that you're just a bit of stardust. I mean, that's a kind of a.
It's a gift as well.
Yes, it's very beautiful, and it has a sort of sacramental element to it. It's you don't have to be chuffing the wacky tobacky to find that a slightly cosmic idea that, particularly when you're out, somewhere where there's bits of meteorite in a desert where you've got fossilised shells and fish, where you can see the footprints of ancient creatures. It's dust to dust and stardust to stardust, and you can lie on the ground, and when you, as Jaxie says, you lie on the ground and at night and you look out to the stars and realise that it's not a backdrop, that it's 3D, that there's stuff behind stuff behind stuff, and you get dizzy, and you get almost panicky, but then he says it's kind of cool, and now he gets why old Fenton keeps talking about heavenly bodies, and it's not the heavenly bit that attracts him, it's the fact that these are places.
Because he's never really left his town before, has he?
No, he's stuck in the world he's from, the mental world, the geographical world.
Yeah.
But I think the way we moderns and postmoderns live, we still treat the night sky, those of us who can actually see it, like it's backdrop, like it's one-dimensional. I mean, in a sense, we have the scientific advantage of knowing that when the Earth's not flat and that the sky is not a canopy and a pane, but we live like that and we think like that. And it's just every now and again, if you get sort of shunted out of your normal existence and your normal way of seeing the world, you have these gift moments where you think, far out, yeah, it is, these are all places, and these are, and the, you know, the light that's coming from them is ancient. These are, everything that you're seeing out there is the energy from an ancient event.
Do you spend much time in the outback? I mean, do you find
I live out in the edge of the desert, and I'm sort of surrounded by that stuff all the time. But I go out into it from whenever I can, because, well, there's no phone signal for one thing.
to escape.
Yeah, but also just for the pleasure of it, and every now and again, just to get sorted, I suppose. And just getting sorted, by the natural world isn't a very romantic or gentle experience. It's sometimes like getting beaten up. But I think that the way that we live means that, we need a bit of a flogging now and again, just to wake up and have some things returned to us. We've come into a time in history where we forget how to be humans. And some of us aren't even interested in being humans. We want to modify ourselves to the point where we leave the creaturely part of us behind. But I don't know. I always find it's a bit of a gift to be a creature.
That was Tim Winton talking to Toby Lishtig. If you missed last week's paper and want to read our exclusive extract from the novel, go to the-tls.co.uk. You'll find it and a great deal more there.